Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
We're only going to take a look at six verses, and it's because there's this character that just shows up, you know, and it's like he shows up out of nowhere. And it's this guy named Melchizedek. Now, how many of you just so I know, how many of you have heard of Melchizedek before? Can I see your hands? All right, that's pretty good. So later on in life, when you're getting ready to name a child, you know, and you say, you know, I've got an idea. We'll name this child Melchizedek, and we'll call this child Mel, because nobody's going to call their child Melchizedek. He just shows up. And if you take a look at the first six verses, and I just want to read them to you, and I want to unpack the significance of this person, because he is a huge figure in Scripture, even though he's somewhat cryptic. He's not like all over the place. And it shows us something. You know, one of the things that it shows us, we think, hey, if something is really important, then it's probably going to be mentioned over and over and over and over and over again in the Bible. You might want to exercise a little caution before you go there. Because Melchizedek, as well as some others, are incredibly important figures, but they're not mentioned over and over and over again. So here's the way that the text reads. It says, "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed in matters pertaining to God for the people, to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he is also clothed with weakness. And because of this, he must make an offering for his own sins as well as for the people. No one takes this honor on himself. Instead, a person is called by God, just as Aaron was. And in the same way, Christ did not exalt himself to become a high priest, but God, who said to him, 'You are my son, and I have become your father,' also says in another place, 'You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.'" That's interesting. Because you have Jesus, who is connected to the order of Melchizedek. And you go, so Melchizedek must be a pretty important person. So let me just talk a little bit about what's going on here. And let me start with this. It's the high priest. You know, it's mentioned, "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed in matters pertaining to God for the people." Appointed by God, that's first, and for the people, that's second. That's who the high priests were. That's the way that they were supposed to do shop. See, God made specific commands to help ensure that the high priest would minister with compassion. Sometimes one of the things that you see, kind of a connection to today, would be somebody like me. It would be someone that's given an office of elder or overseer in the church. And part of the responsibility is to provide the watch and care over the church and to do it with compassion. Even if you look at the description of what an elder is supposed to be, their temperament really matters, at least according to Paul. The temperament of an elder really matters. And so they're supposed to lead with a heart and with compassion. They would wear a breastplate, and I drew this for you. I'm kidding, I didn't do that. So here's this image, right? And it kind of looks like a Sunday school image a little bit. However, if you look at it, there's some significance here. Because in the breastplate of the high priest, and you can kind of see the square that's around the chest, in the breastplate of the high priest were set 12 stones. And the 12 stones were engraved with the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And part of what this was supposed to signify or symbolize is that that person was to represent all 12 of the tribes to God. So on the chest. The other thing is it wasn't just on the chest, but, and this is a little bit harder to see, you see shoulder straps that go over the shoulders and down the back. And the shoulder straps also had the stones engraved with the names of the tribes on them as well. And here's what that was supposed to mean. In this, the people of Israel were always supposed to be on the heart and on the shoulders of the high priest. It's deeply symbolic. And we see this in Exodus chapter 28, if you were to read verses 4 through 30. We're not. I just want you to see where it's coming from. So the high priest was always to have the people on heart, but also carry their weight on his shoulders. Now that's what leads us into this interesting discussion about Melchizedek, because he's only mentioned a couple of times in the Bible, other than here in Hebrews, and Hebrews talks about him really more than anywhere else. But other than here in Hebrews, you also see him mentioned in Genesis 14, 17. Here's what it says. It says, after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer, I know you're all going to go remember that. Actually, this week I've been calling that guy Chad. So after Abram returned from defeating Chad and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the Sheva Valley, that is the king's valley. Melchizedek, there's his mention, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest to God Most High. He blessed him and he said, Abram is blessed by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High who has handed over your enemies to you. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Here's like your first mention of Melchizedek and what's happening. You have Abram leading out in battle, and once God has given him the victory, he finds a priest to go to so that he can make an offering back to God because of everything that God has given him. That's huge, because when you think, if you think Old Testament, and you go, who are the biggies, right? Abram is going to come up, and he should. Moses is going to come up, and he should. You can think of things. But here you've got one of the big names and all of the leaders of ancient Israel going to this guy. And what this shows you is that even though Abram is huge to them, if he's paying Melchizedek a tithe, then he's in some senses greater than him. Abram's going to him for this. The other thing, did you notice? He's two things for them. He's a king and he's a priest. Melchizedek is both a king and he is a priest of the Most High God. It's strange because this guy, that he's come out of nowhere. We don't know where he comes from. Bible doesn't tell us. We don't know who he descended from. Who are his parents? We don't know. Who's the rest of his family? We don't know. How did he come to know God? We don't know. It doesn't tell us. Who anointed him to be the priest? We don't know. The text doesn't tell us. But after Abram had won this battle, he knew he wanted to thank God for the victory, and this is the guy that he goes to. So Abram must have already known who he was. He was already set up in rank and position, and sometimes we go, he's set up with power, but I think what he's really got is responsibility. I mean, we're looking into an election cycle right now. Did you know that? Did you know you're already seeing people running for, I think we have about 800-900 people running for president, and I've decided to do it in my spare time. So we already have this election cycle that's happening. Have you noticed the one of the words that keeps getting brought up is, you know, whoever it is that's going to be the president of the United States is going to be one of the most powerful people in all of the world, which, by the way, in a sense, is true. But wouldn't it be refreshing if you hear the people that are running for office to speak of it in terms of my responsibility? My responsibility to represent the people of the United States. That's my job. Wouldn't it be great to hear somebody say something like that? I'm just going to throw it out there, right? Responsibility. It's no different when we talk about Melchizedek. He has a God-given responsibility as the high priest to represent the people to God. By the way, after that verse, after that three-verse reference that I just shared for you in Genesis chapter 14, Melchizedek disappears. He's gone. You never hear anything about him for about, 1,000 years. Almost 1,000 years. When David makes a prophecy in the Psalms, and it's specifically at Psalm 110, he makes a prophecy about the Messiah. And what he says in Psalm 110 is that he would be, and I just quote, he would be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That is the prophecy, by the way, that was just mentioned here in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. So you have Hebrews 5 talking about him, referencing Psalm 110 that's talking about him, that's going back to Genesis chapter 14 that's talking about him, Melchizedek. So who is this guy? I'm glad you asked. I'm going to give you a few things to think about this morning. Are you ready? Here's the first thing. Melchizedek is the king of Salem. He's the king of Salem. And you go, well, who are they? Well, Salem was a city-state in the land of Canaan. The word Salem means full or complete, safe, whole, or peaceful. Melchizedek is the king of the place of peace. the author of Hebrews calls attention to this when comparing Melchizedek to Jesus. Melchizedek is the king of peace, and Jesus is also the king of peace. And we see this in Hebrews chapter 7, verse 2. And that's interesting to me, at least for a couple of reasons. I mean, remember the whole rebellion with, I talked about King Chad because I wasn't going to mention his whole long name multiple times. This whole rebellion with King Chad that started the mess back in Genesis 14, well, here's what was going on. Chad had three loyal kings on his side. There were five disloyal kings that were fighting against him. Each of these kings seemed to have ruled some kind of city-state area. So you can imagine, this is not that hard to imagine, because you have basically eight different kings fighting with each other. Some have partnered up with others basically to form strength and strongholds. But guess which city never enters the fray in all of the fighting? Guess which one is never mentioned? And the answer is Salem. Salem never comes up. This city seems to live up to the safe and peaceful part of its name. Unlike everybody else around them, these people knew peace. This is also interesting because the ancient town of Salem later becomes a place called Jerusalem, which is where the temple of God that Solomon built was going to stand. So you see how the author of Hebrews would be especially keen. He wants to connect Jesus to Melchizedek. Jesus is the son of David, the king of Jerusalem, and Jesus is the high priest of a new covenant, just like Melchizedek was a priest representing the people to God. Jesus now represents you to God. You see the connection? His name, Melchizedek, means the king of righteousness. The author of Hebrews brings this up in his argument for Jesus' greatness in Hebrews chapter 7, verse 2. The name, when you look at Melchizedek, it comes from two Hebrew words. The first is Malak, which means king or ruler, and the second is Sadak, which means righteous or just and innocent. That's who he is. Jesus is also the king of righteousness. He is also the one that is perfectly innocent. He is also the one that reigns with justice. The order of Melchizedek is given a description here. It's described as royal, kingly, and everlasting. Nothing is going to put a stop to this. The 110th Psalm, which I mentioned before, is a messianic. This is a Jesus prophecy that tells us two things that God promised to do for Jesus. He was going to make Jesus the king in Zion, and he was going to make Jesus a priest. This is Psalm 110:4. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And of course, the permanence of Melchizedek's order, priestly order, is important to the author of Hebrews. He's talking about it. Since Jesus is the resurrected great high priest. Who is this guy? That's who he is. And he has a new covenant that only comes through him. This is the point. Melchizedek, why I bring this guy up is because Melchizedek the whole time was pointing to someone greater. Just like that story where you look at Abram going to him saying, I'm actually pointing to someone greater. Melchizedek, who is considered great, is pointing to the greatest, and that's Jesus. So who's Jesus? Who's he? If Melchizedek is pointing to him, who is he? And the answer is, he is a king, and he is a high priest. He's both. One of the things that you saw about Melchizedek is that he was both. He was a king, and he was a priest. As a priest, that means that he would have a square with the 12 tribes basically over his chest so that he always keeps his people on his heart. That means he has the straps over his shoulders so that he helps to carry the weight of what it is that his people were enduring. By the way, nobody else in the Old Testament was like that. Nobody. There is one. King and priest were two offices that you never combined in the Old Testament and wouldn't want to combine. It would be like combining a police officer with a mafia boss. You don't want to do that, right? Now, that was a bad joke. I'm glad you laughed. You don't want to combine those offices. And the reason that you don't want to combine them is because what the offices meant, what it is that they represented, what it is that they were asked to do. They were different kinds of things. The king was a lawgiver. The king was also a judge. The priest was the one that was a friend. The priest was the one that was a counselor. The priest was the one who could sympathize with people in their weakness and then help them in the places that they messed up to get them to where they ought to be. And so you didn't want these offices combined because you need someone that's going to be representing justice, and you need someone else that's going to be showing compassion and mercy. They never combined the offices because one person, as they thought, you can't actually do both. So Melchizedek is the one exception. And the next, by the way, was Jesus. You have two, Melchizedek and Jesus. In chapter 7, verse 14, it says that Jesus was not from the tribe of Levi, where all of the other Old Testament priests were from. He is from the tribe of Judah, which is the tribe of the kings. He's the king. But how can Jesus rule with perfect justice in a way that sympathizes with us in our weakness? Just like Melchizedek, who combines the two offices, and you go, how does he do that? How does he rule with perfect justice while all the time meeting us in the place of greatest weakness that we have? And the answer is, that is the cross. That's the cross. The cross was where the absolute justice of God met the fullness of his mercy. The debt we owed to God our King was paid by God the Son, so that now he relates to us both with mercy and acceptance without compromising his justice. I want you to think about that for a second. There are stories where a child has broken the law. The child goes and stands in the court, and basically a heavy fine is leveraged onto the child. We have instances, even in the American judicial system, where fathers have paid the debt of the child in a court. What happened when the debt got paid? And the answer is, everything in terms of the matters of justice were actually met. There was a debt that was owed to the state, and the debt was paid, even if the debt wasn't paid by the perpetrator. Instead, it's one that represents the perpetrator. The debt is gone. That's the cross. It reminds me of something Jerry Bridges said some years ago that captured my attention. It is something that I have never forgotten, and I hope that it reaches your heart this morning. He said, "Our worst days are never so bad that you are beyond the reach of God's grace. Our worst days are never so bad that you are beyond the reach of God's grace. And your best days are never so good that you are beyond the need of God's grace." Question, what are you, for some of you, it's what are you going through? Some of you have come in here and you have a lot of pain in your heart. What I want you to see is you have this picture of Jesus where he is a high priest that has the shoulder straps and he is helping carry the weight for you. If you just put it on his shoulder, put it on him. This is what the high priest was meant to do. Some of you have come in, and basically what you're sitting here is you're trying to hold a secret of something in your life because honestly, to admit it is so embarrassing. Some choice that you've made, something that you've done, and I don't necessarily mean this week, I just mean something in your life that you have carried with you. It's like the weight that we're talking about here. And what is Jesus trying to say the whole time? You weren't meant to carry the weight. It wasn't it. You made the choice, but I'm here to carry the weight. The only question is, are you going to let him? Our worst days are never so bad that you are beyond the reach of God's grace. Never. And your best days are never so good that you are beyond the need of God's grace. I want to give you a closing thought on why this matters this morning. A story that I ran into some years ago, and if you give me just the freedom, I want to read it to you. Charlotte Elliott of Brighton, England, she lived from 1789 to 1871, was either born or in early life had become an invalid. Her life was a testimony to endurance and suffering, not only physical, but also emotional and spiritual. This was the context in which she wrote a hymn. As her nephew, the Reverend Handley Mole, recounted in 1897, and this is the part that I just wanted to read to you. He said this about her. He said, ill health still beset her. It often caused her the peculiar pain of a seeming uselessness in her life while the circle around her was full of unresting service ableness for God. Such a time of trial marked the year 1834 when she was 45 years old and living in Westfield Lodge, Brighton. Her brother, the Reverend H.V. Eliot, had not long before conceived the plan of St. Mary's Hall at Brighton. It was a school designed to give, at nominal cost, a high education to the daughters of ministers. In aid of St. Mary's Hall, there was to be held a bazaar. Westfield Lodge was all astir. Every member of the large circle was occupied morning and night in preparations, with the one exception of the ailing sister Charlotte. As full of eager interest as any of them, but physically fit for nothing. The night before the bazaar, she was kept wakeful by distressing thoughts of her apparent uselessness. And these thoughts passed, and as these thoughts passed, by a transition easy to imagine into a spiritual conflict, till she questioned the reality of her whole spiritual life and wondered whether it were anything better than an illusion of the emotions, an illusion ready to be sorrowfully dissolved. Or the way that she would describe it, she would just prefer to be dead. The next day, the busy day of the bazaar, she lays on her sofa. The troubles of the night comes back on her with such a force that she felt they must be met and conquered in the grace of God. She gathered up her soul in the great certainties, not of her emotions, but of Jesus, of his power and of his promise. And then she takes pen and paper from the table, and she deliberately sits down and she writes for her own comfort what she called the formula of her faith. And I think a lot of you know what it is. Just as I am, and without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, and that thou bidst me come to thee, O Lamb of God, I come. Just as I am, and waiting not to rid my soul of one dark blot, to thee whose blood can cleanse each spot, O Lamb of God, I come. In a place of seeming uselessness, absolute worthlessness to Jesus, she writes a song that we still sing today. The reason that I even bring her story up is because all of our story is like hers. Every single one of us, our story is like hers. And what I mean by that is simply this. We have the opportunity to take a life, and all I want people to see every single week is that you are created by God for so much more, so much more, so much more. And to take his hand and to walk into what he wants to offer you. But we have to see ourselves the way that she saw herself. And she says, to thee I come. I come. And so I want to spend a moment just in a time of prayer. You have a time where you are removed from the distractions of the week. I know there's a lot. I know it. But for some of you, it's not a matter of had you made the decision some years ago to call yourself a follower of Jesus. It's that you look at your life and you know that you're not following him. I think for some of you, you take a hard and honest look at your life and you say, good, I mean, there's not much different between me and the demons. The demons believe in Jesus and they shudder. But there isn't anything about my life that I can describe as fully given over to him. In fact, for some of you this morning, you take a hard look at your life, and what you know is that sin constantly seems to have the upper hand. You feel like you're constantly in a place of defeat. Here's the story. To Jesus, you come. You come. And what you have in the high priest, I want you to ever forget this imagery, is that around his heart is your name, and on his shoulders is your guilt, and you were never made for shame to begin with. You put it on him. People, that is the cross. The only question is are you ready this morning to put it there? That's the choice that you have to make. Jesus doesn't make it for you. You can come, and this is the beauty of it. You can come fully disclosing, full honesty, lay everything on the table. And everything that you see described in the book of Hebrews is that Jesus, just like in the order of Melchizedek, is going to meet you in the place of your heart and take you from where you are to where he created you to be. Don't you want that this morning? What it requires is just a couple of things. A humility to recognize what is in us, and a humility that recognizes our need for the change that only he can bring. Question is this morning, are you ready? Are you ready? So I want to lead us in a time of prayer. Let's consecrate this moment to Jesus. What is it that you want to lay at his feet? And so I ask you just to bow your heads. For some of you, you came in not as a believer. For some of you, you came in today looking for the truth. Jesus says, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me. And just as you would see from the high priest from the time of the Old Testament, he would make an atonement for sins. The way that the book of Hebrews describes Jesus is the cross is the final atonement for all of the sins of all people, everywhere, at all time. And what that means is for whosoever will may come, Jesus says this morning, I'm inviting you to come. What he wants you to experience is his forgiveness. What he wants you to experience is his grace. What he wants you to experience is to know that the sin that weighs you down can be put on him and it's dealt with. And you can walk away with the assurance of his promise and you can walk away in the freedom of his forgiveness. I invite you, if you're here this morning and you are ready to pray and to accept what Jesus is offering you, to pray with me now and to pray this. Lord Jesus, I come as a sinner. And what I know is that I need your grace and your forgiveness. I'm asking you, Lord, to forgive me. I'm asking you, Lord, to give me a clean heart. I'm asking you, Lord, to make me new. I thank you, Lord, because I know the wages of sin is death. I know that your gift is free life through Jesus Christ. And so this morning, I'm casting all of that on you. I'm casting all of that on you. And I'm asking you to make me new from the inside out. Quick question. For those of you that are here, and you prayed that with me this morning, our staff, we want to minister to you because that prayer is only the first step. And what I ask you to do is we'll be up front after the service dismisses here just in a few moments. And we want to pray with you. We want to celebrate this decision with you, and we want to help you. But if you prayed that prayer this morning to receive Jesus, nobody's looking. If you could, just so that we can help you out, could you raise your hand this morning so that we can see you? Thank you so much. So, church, one of the things I want you to see, one of the things that I want you to see, because believers, I want to talk for you just a second. When you gave your life to Jesus, you gave your guilt to Jesus, and there's no reason for you to walk around in guilt. No reason. What you do is you walk around in victory. You walk in victory. You are forgiven. It is over. The difference is as we leave this place this morning, is that you were blessed by Jesus to be a blessing to somebody that needs a blessing. And this week, I encourage you to accept the challenge.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.